So good morning, Professor Finney. Thank you very much for joining me this morning. As we've discussed ahead of time, the general theme of this series of interviews is the history of spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking. In your case, however, we'll be talking about ideas that were in the air mostly before the advent of these, or were parallel in the world of structural glasses, which are intimately related in some ways to spin glasses. So to talk a bit more first about your own background, can you tell us a bit more about your family and studies before starting the university?
Yeah, I was brought up in a town just south of Manchester, and I went to a grammar school after age 11. And that, I suppose, is where I got interested in the physics, largely through, I think, A, inspirational teachers, and B, also perhaps realizing that if I specialized in something apart from a science subject, then the science would probably be a closed book to me for the rest of my life, whereas I could still be doing other things while I in the background, if you like. And so it was really, it was actually inspirational teachers. I was interested, challenged by the subject. I wanted to know how the world worked, and that was a good enough incentive.
So what brought you to Cambridge then, and to do physics?
Again, same reasons. So I went in on physics, chemistry, mathematics examination, and I got in, I think, on the chemistry, and immediately dropped it because it was really rather boring, and just basically focused on the physics, with a bit of metallurgy and crystallography thrown in, which was probably quite useful for the rest of the stuff I ended up doing.
So you worked in particular during your undergrad with Ellen McGaugh, I think, if I understand, as a crystallographer. Can you tell us a bit more about that experience?
No, she was one of the crystallography lecturers. A bit dry. I didn't realize at the time, you know, how sort of famous a person she was, just like a lot of the other lecturers we had. And if I'd known then what I knew now, I'd have been asking them all sorts of things about the building of the atomic bomb, for example, when, you know, some of my lecturers there were actually involved in the physics of it, and in the discovery of fission. So a missed opportunity in those cases, I must say. But the crystallography at that point was what's called a half subject. I had to choose a number of courses, one of which the main courses was physics, and then I had to choose others. And I was offered geology, but my supervisor said, "Don't bother about geology. There's no money in it." And so I didn't do any geology, but I did the crystallography, which I think stood me a good stead later on.
So did you do research as well with her, or was this just a one class you took?
No, she was just one of the lecturers. Of the practical, I did a crystallography practical, which was really just taking data on a powder and getting essentially cell dimensions and things from it. That introduced me to the problems of computing. This was in the very early days. We processed the data on the old Exact 2 computer, which had five-hole perforated tape input. And I think it took me far longer to correct all the parity errors in the holes as it did to do the rest of the project.
So was that your first interactions with computers then? Or you had?
Was indeed, yes. Yes.
Yeah. So what then drew you to pursue a PhD in crystallography with J.D. Bernal in particular?
Well, that goes back to my school days, because I remember one of the classes we were doing with one of the school teachers called Roger Stone, who was head of physics. And we were doing a class on solids and gases, which was all very straightforward. So we learned all about solids, crystalline solids, and we learned all about gases. And so Muggins here thought, well, there's something missing here. So I said, well, Lisa, what about liquids? To which he said, liquids are very difficult, but there's a guy at Birkbeck College who's trying to do something about them. So that just somehow got parked in the back of my mind somewhere. And when it came many years later for me to think of what I'd like to do, whether I'd want to do any research in physics, because at the time I was training for teaching. I was doing a postgraduate education course. And partly, I think, because A, idealistic, I wanted to actually teach, and B, I wanted a break from what was a highly intensive undergraduate course. And but after the teaching 1 year course, I thought, well, let's see about the research, and I'll approach this guy at Birkbeck. So I just wrote a letter and I got invited down to talk to him, and then things moved from there.
So there was no relationship between your undergraduate crystallography experience and
your PhD? No, not whatsoever. Apart from the fact that it meant that when I registered to do the MSc in crystallography at Birkbeck, they suddenly decided that I'd done the Cambridge course and said, don't bother. So I didn't bother.
So your thesis with Bernal worked on disordered packings of hard spheres, right, in that context. And if I understand correctly, that thesis involved using particle positions obtained from physical hard sphere models and analyzing them with computational tools for geometrical analysis. So why was direct simulations of hard spheres being crunched? Or why weren't you using synthetic hard sphere positions at that point to do
generating on the computer?
Yes.
But if you look at what Bernal was saying in the early 60s, he was aware of the work that was going on at Los Alamos, for example. But he said even with the computational power they had, they were limited to small numbers. And he really wanted to get away from the problems of boundary effects and to be able to try to squash the thing into the maximum density possible in order to actually see what the geometry was like. And so, in essence, I was there to, at least in the early stages, to build on the work he'd done on small models and to build a large model where I could more or less guarantee, because of the way we did it, there were no significant boundary effects, and to try to achieve the maximum possible density without any crystallization. And that, at the time, was far too big a challenge for computational abilities at the time. I mean, looking at things now, I mean, it's a totally different matter, of course. I mean, I could have done all the computing that I did for my thesis, playing probably about half an hour on my phone, but, you know, things then were very different. It's a question of taking in tapes to the computer in the evening and running overnight when there was nothing else going on, and then poring over the results the day after. It was a very different world in terms of computing. And Bernal did actually, in his earlier days, try computing approaches. When he set up his lab at Birkbeck, he was aware of the possibilities of computing, particularly in terms of crystallographic structure solutions. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was a small computing department, which in the end sort of amalgamated with the University Computing Service. And he did try several ways of doing it by computer, but found, in fact, it was far, far too computationally difficult, and he couldn't see any way of getting over the limitations of computational power at the time. But I mean, after the thesis, I suppose, during the thesis work, I did some simulations with soft spheres, where in fact things are somewhat easier to deal with than hard spheres. And as you see, if you look at the work I published in 1970, you could see how the packing, the hard sphere packing, when you soften it, actually went quite close to what you would get for something like liquid argon, liquid inert gases, etc.
So for your thesis proper, where did these two, I think there's two configurations you were working with, right? Where did they come from? How were they obtained?
Oh, the main packing I used, the dense packing, was made by taking a load of steel balls, quarter inch steel balls, ball bearings, and compressing those in a football bladder, which would, well, not a football bladder, it was a balloon, if you like, mm-hmm. which was dotted with hard spheres or steel balls of different sizes to try to give a non-regular outer surface to try to prevent crystallization. And then that was then just essentially sealed that up, worked it, kneaded it, if you like, as if you're making bread, and knead it as much as you possibly could, and then hope you'd got to a stage where it was the maximum density. And then poured wax into the system and let it solidify, and then peel off the outer layers and measure the coordinates optically, peeling them off layer by layer and melting the wax, etc. So it was a fairly long, lengthy period. It was about 9,000 hard spheres, which took a bit of time to measure. And then, of course, you then work on the data. That was the hard sphere model. Yeah. The loose packing data I worked on was that from David Scott. I didn't do any of the loose packing stuff at all in terms of constructing models.
And how did you obtain the coordinates from Professor Scott? Did you have a relationship?
Bernal had got hold of them beforehand.
Okay, so you never were in touch with Professor Scott yourself? You were just...
Yes, in discussion. I mean, he was interested in the results that were coming out. So, you know, the letters going backwards and forwards every now and then. And I did drop in to see him when I was in Pittsburgh for that year. Mm. But by that time, of course, most of this work had finished.
What was the reception to your work, the immediate reception to your work on these packings?
It depends on the audience. It was generally positive, but there was a marked resistance from what I would call, you know, the dyed-in-the-wool theoreticians who were working on models which were either compressed gases using assumptions which were not valid at the densities with the liquids, at the density of a liquid, mm-hmm. or working on disordered crystals, which of course was totally inconsistent with the ideas that we were developing. So some theoreticians found the concept rather difficult to accept, though the importance of the excluded volume in controlling the structure did appear to be realized by some. For example, there was a Faraday discussion in 67 on liquids, and John Rowlandson, who you may have heard about, a major theoretician in liquids, did actually come out and say, well, you know, this has demonstrated the importance of repulsive forces in controlling structures, which is quite obvious, I suppose, to a crystallographer. But I certainly at that time, being, you know, a young sort of a young scientist without much experience of the scientific world, was saying, well, you know, these guys aren't actually thinking about structure. They're just playing around with equations, and they can't actually see what the reality of those equations is. That might have been an attitude which had been encouraged or implied, if you like, by the way Bernal looked at these things, because he had similar views. You know, the theoreticians thought this was a crazy way to work. You know, you play with equations. There were exceptions. John Zeiman was extremely positive about the work that was coming up, and was very, very complimentary about it. And, you know, I was very grateful for that encouragement. And also, soon after the work had finished, I was phoned up by Peter Egelstaff, who may or may not have come across, again, another theoretician, who I got to know a lot better later on, who just was about to move from Harwell to Waterloo in Canada. And I went over to Harwell to talk to him, and he was very interested in trying to use the data that we got to calculate triplet correlations, if you like, in the system, which I played around with a bit, but then he popped off to Waterloo and that sort of ground to a halt. So there was quite a lot of positive response, but quite a lot of, I think, the theoretical world weren't thinking in this sort of way. Mm-hmm. You know, Bernal was a crystallographer as well as, you know, a polymath, and he wanted to try to see and have a concept. I mean, what I think some of the things he said in this Bakurian lecture, I think are worth looking at. The atoms can't approach closer than a certain distance. And that is actually going to be a relevant control on structure until covalent and directional forces come in, which will of course make differences.
So you mentioned that Bernal was in touch with the Los Alamos group early on about their simulation work. Were you at all involved or in discussions with?
No,
with
them? I can't say he was in contact with them. He was aware of it.
Okay.
And he mentioned it in his Bakurian lecture, and said that, you know, in essence that he didn't see that computing was that far enough advanced to be able to do the job computationally. I wasn't in touch with, apart from I had one interaction, I think, with Wood, but it wasn't very positive. I think I can't remember how it came about. I probably got a letter somewhere in the loft, but it would take me several weeks probably to find it. You'll be aware of that sort of problem.
Okay. But you were not comparing results with their simulations, for instance, or?
No, I did later on. I don't know if you've seen the paper I wrote in PhilMag in 2013, mm-hmm. Which was the result of a meeting in Dublin, which Dennis Weir organized, where I looked at the sort of, at some of their results, and their packings were all of significantly lower density than the limits that we were working at, which perhaps justifies, in fact, perhaps Bernal's position on that the computations weren't, at that time, were not sufficiently capable of getting to the conditions that he wished to get to.
So after your thesis, you obtained a lectureship at Birkbeck, but you went on a sabbatical or postdoctoral leave at Pittsburgh for a year in 1971, yeah, with Jeffrey. So what drew you to work with him and go to the U.S. at that point?
I went to the triennial International Union of Crystallography meeting in 1969 in Stony Brook. I didn't give a paper, but I was at a session there, which there was a paper given by an eminent German scientist on a crystalline, disordered crystalline model of a liquid, which I looked at and thought, well, this is absolute bunkum, you know, this is crazy. But of course, I had data in my back pocket to show, and during the discussion, I showed this data, and Jeffrey was in the audience. I didn't know at the time, but he came to me at breakfast the day after, and was quite amused by the way I'd actually treated this eminent German scientist, and said, "Come to Pittsburgh for a year." So I thought, well, why not? I'd like to spend a year in the States with another department and get some wider experience, and it will gives me a great opportunity to meet a whole load of other scientists that I may not have chance to meet. And in fact, it was very helpful because, I mean, by that time I was moving further away into aqueous solutions, water and liquids, aqueous solutions and water biomolecule systems. And I was able to make a lot of good contacts by being over in the States. For example, I was invited to Yale to give talks with my Fred Richards, etc. And that was all very helpful for my future work. So it was good. And I didn't do much work on the simple liquids then. It was I did some straightforward crystallography and did a bit more computing on more powerful computers than I've been used to using, and it was all very good. And I'm very grateful to that opportunity, but it did come about in rather a strange way, I thought. You insult a German scientist and you get invited to a year in the States. So I should say that the gentleman concerned there were no hard feelings, and we had some good drinking sessions afterwards. It also resulted in my, well, seeing again how some aspects of science were working. You know, bear in mind, I was under 30 at this point. As a result of that Stony Brook session, I got invited to MIT or to Harvard, Dave Turnbull's group. He had one of his co-workers there, Slade Cargill, who was presenting structural data on an amorphous metal alloy. And he showed this RDF, radial distribution function, which had, instead of the simple radial distribution of a simple liquid, where you have a first shot peak and then a second peak, his second peak was split. And that was exactly the behavior that we'd been finding in the hard sphere packings. And so as a result of him seeing that slide, I got invited to have a talk with Dave and his group, which again was very good. I enjoyed that interaction. It was very, very helpful to me. But I was a bit taken aback a year or so later when I found a paper in Nature reproducing my data and claiming it as this is a model of the structure of an amorphous metal, without any suggestion that I might be involved in the paper. So it was not a very pleasant experience from that point of view. And perhaps underlying the fact that one ought to be very careful about how you use other people's data and what ethics there should be operating within the scientific community.
So that first trip to Cambridge in Massachusetts was at the same time as the conference?
It was just after the conference, yes.
Okay.
I was staying over at the time. My then wife had a brother who was at Yale. Okay. And we'd planned to spend some time after the conference with them. And so it was simple enough then to just jump up to Boston. And also there's another crystallographic colleague who was at Birkbeck at the time, but who was American from Tufts. And he was over visiting his parents in Kingston, Rhode Island. And so we had an invitation to go and spend a day or two with them. And so we said, okay, fine, we'll go and see the people in Cambridge, and then we'll come back and spend two couple of nights with you in Kingston on the way back.
I see. So coming back to Birkbeck, you started working or using these packing models for a variety of contexts, including structural glasses yourself.
Yeah.
So where did your interest in glasses arise from, that interaction with the Turnbull group, or?
No, it was before. It was when I was working on the, I'd seen a paper in Nature, I think somewhere, where there was a radial distribution function presented of, it's probably palladium silicon or something, 80-20. And there was some suggestion there of a split second peak. And in one of my discussions with Bernal, I said, well, hang on, why don't we look at this as a model of a structural model of a glass? And he didn't seem particularly interested, but and more or less I was given, if you like, the freedom to go and develop that line of things if I wished to. And in fact, there was probably far more interest in the packing work amongst the metallic glass community than there was amongst the liquid community. And so we began to do some work on, or look at some of the problems of looking at binary systems. We did some preliminary calculations or computations on building binary systems. But there was quite a lot of interaction then for a few years with the Met Glass community, people, Japanese, the American group, you know, Dave Turnbull, etc. And in the UK, Robert Kahn, who you may have come across at Sussex and his group. In terms of the UK operation, Robert was really, if you like, running whatever collaborations there were. And there were several meetings I went to, and we discussed structures and problems of characterizing structures, etc.
So as you got in touch eventually with Charles Bennett, who was working computational algorithms to generate disordered packings, sidestepping in a sense the compression. Yeah. How did that interaction come about? And
it came around. It came about during the visit to Dave Turnbull.
Oh, the same time. Okay.
Except Charles wasn't around the day I turned up. He was out somewhere else. But he got in touch somehow with me. I can't. It must have been a message I got or phoned or something to Turnbull. I can't remember how. And he was coming back. He was getting back in Boston about late afternoon on the day we were leaving, about 6 o'clock on the train. And so I said, "Yeah, well, the only way we can get together is if you come down to the station and we can talk." So we started talking at the station. And carried on talking, and he got on the train, and he came all the way to Kingston, Rhode Island on the train, stayed for dinner, and caught the last train back to Boston. So that's how it started.
And then you kept in touch?
Yes, we did. And we published a joint paper, which is probably worth forgetting. We kept in touch. As much of when he went off to Argonne at some point, working with Mies Raman, and we made some contact there when we were working with on computer simulation of water and such like. Mm-hmm. But no, Charles convinced me that the coordination number should be 6 exactly, which we examined later on in some of the models, and we came to the same conclusion. Charles was dropped by in London about 2 or 3 years ago, and so we met up again, which is good. But I haven't seen him for decades.
Okay.
You have much interact with him? I mean, he's not working on this sort of stuff anymore, of course. He had this lovely story when he was trying to build or try to show a packing on the screen computationally, to write the code to actually exhibit the packing. And he said the most difficult thing to do was to code in hidden line removal. And now you look at computer games these days. I mean, you know, it was a different world. I mean, you won't have seen it, you know. I mean, you hadn't been born at that time.
So in the early 1970s, some physicists were suggesting an analogy between low temperature properties of structural glasses and of spin glasses. There's a work notably of Phil Anderson, Bert Halperin, and Barma. Given that you were working on disordered packings, which are essentially zero temperature version of liquids, were you paying attention to this proposal? Was this on your radar or part of discussions?
Not really. It at that point I was moving much more into non-spherical systems at water, and it was in the periphery, but it wasn't something that I felt I should be putting a lot of effort into, I'm afraid.
So you nevertheless wrote the review a few years later in 1977 for Nature on modeling of structures of amorphous metals and alloys.
Yeah.
In which you reiterated your, you know, the status that you thought that the quench rates achieved by molecular dynamics were far too high to compare with what is relevant experimentally. Were you nevertheless a paying attention to the work being done at that point, which had, you know, a few generations of computer later by, say, Leslie Woodcock and Julian Gibbs, who were looking at denser supercooled liquids? And if yes, what was your impression of the work at that point?
Les, I think I said earlier that when I was doing the listening my thesis work on soft sphere systems, I was using Les's software.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, we made contact during that time when he was at Royal Holloway. And we came across each other from time to time since then. And I knew he was actually trying to, if you like, get a high density packing. And which was fine. And when he got it, I was delighted because he got exactly the same answers we did for the maximum density. So you know, we've crossed paths every now and then. We did some collaborative work on crystallization, trying to identify crystallization from a randomly packed structure. And there is a joint paper there in the literature on that. Essentially, he did the computation, I did the structure analysis, and it worked quite well.
And what about the group of Julian Gibbs, who was contemporary to Les' work?
Yeah, I mean, they worked together. I didn't do any work with Julian. I examined one of his PhD students once.
Okay.
I was aware of what they were doing. That was fine. And it was good to see the results that came out of it.
So can you give us a feeling for what the community of people who were interested in hard spheres and packing at that point, were there any dedicated meeting? Were there collaborations, or was this really just independent groups with loose communications pathways?
I'm not sure I can answer that because, you know, by then I was moving elsewhere. I think there were groups that were working and there were groups that were interacting, and there were, I've been to the odd meeting where different groups got together and they talked about some of the problems they had. I remember one in particular in Manchester, when Les was in Manchester at the time. I got the impression there were a few groups around the country that were working, but collaborating and interacting with each other. And I suspect they all knew what they were doing and they were working in a collaborative fashion, as far as I could tell.
Mm-hmm. So
that was the British community. In terms of the international community, then I think we talked about that before. It was really the metallic classes people. I say Robert Kahn over here, and I did some work with Don Polk. And I was from time to time in touch with Franz Papen. We would talk about things.
So you as you were just, you know, you mentioned a number of times, you were leaving the study of glasses already by the early to mid 70s. Did you stay beyond that review? Did you stay abreast of the advances that were being made? Or was it only through these odd meetings where you were in invited and hearing talks?
I didn't really remain involved at all, I think. Things would pass by me from time to time, but I know by that time I was getting funding to develop other things. And I think since that 77 paper, I don't think I've published anything, have I, since, but not much since then on the hard sphere systems, or a bit on soft spheres, soft sphere refines, soft sphere relaxations and such like, with a group at Bedford, what was then Bedford College. But that really came out of bumping into them at a meeting, and we're deciding we ought to actually see what a hard sphere system would relax to under a Leonard Jones potential, etc., etc. But no, by that time I was getting funding for Aqueous systems, and the group I built up was around that. I think perhaps I should say that at the time, the department, the crystallography department, from mid 70s onwards, was shifting very much to increase its emphasis on structural molecular biology. And so, in a way, I suppose, because of the work I was doing on water and water protein interactions, it was a natural way for me to work and collaborate with others in the department. And so, in a way, I suppose, this move towards the more complex systems was, if you like, lubricated by the internal changes in the department.
So about a decade ago, you nevertheless co-authored a piece with Les Woodcock.
Yeah.
That reviewed Bernal's disordered packing approach to understand liquids and glasses. How did this piece come together?
Les drove it, as is probably obvious from the paper. When I formally retired, whatever that word means, my colleagues insisted on having a little meeting, and of course asked me who I'd like to talk. And because Les had been actually quite helpful and he'd done all this work on packings, it seemed to me that Les would be somebody, be nice to hear what he thought about things at this much later stage. And so I asked him to give a talk at this do. This was in, I think, 2009. And he was very gung-ho, as Les can be, about the Bernal model, and presented data which looked quite good, and suggested that perhaps we should try and think of writing something like this. And so we followed that up from time to time later. And following a visit I stayed with him for a couple of days when I was at a meeting in Bradford, and he was living up in the Yorkshire Dales. And we decided to go ahead and try and do it. And I basically did the hard sphere stuff, and then he wrote the rest of it. It's probably quite clear that it's a who wrote which bit. Have you read it?
I've perused through it, yes. During your time in London or elsewhere, did you ever teach about glasses and or dense packings in general? And if yes, can you detail?
Not in any detail, no. It would just come in as at Birkbeck. I was at Birkbeck until 1988, and there was no real place for it in the MSc in crystallography or in the biomolecular organization class. So my teaching there was essentially diffraction theory, etc., and a bit of, you know, structural chemistry. Mm-hmm. And when I moved to UCL in 1993, then it just would come in a bit as part of a general condensed matter course, but nothing beyond the very basics.
We're approaching the end of this discussion. So is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have overlooked or missed?
I'm not sure much more than I've said. I think there was this clear difference in approach of a scientist who looks at structure in three dimensions and the theoreticians, if you like. It's okay. I've been infected by crystallography in a way, and it seemed to me that if you want to understand something which is made up of things in space, then having some idea of how they're organized is actually quite useful. And but I say in the 60s, this didn't seem to be a way of looking at things. And I think Bernal tried to cut through that. I mean, I think it summarizes the situation. I think that something, again, after getting your list of questions, I looked up a couple of quotes and things. And he said something like, he found all the theories fundamentally unsatisfying to a crystallographer, however much they might appeal to a physical chemist or a mathematician. He wanted a more concrete picture of the structure, and one making use of Occam's razor, not to multiply entities beyond necessity. And he wanted some kind of theory of liquids that was homologous to a crystalline solid, but radically different in kind and have a general quality of homogeneity, without the assumption of any special groups. And I suppose that attitude, you know, it seemed to me a good way of looking at things. And I think it was a minority view. And I mean, you're working in the glass field now, you will know whether that still is a minority view, or whether you think there is some sensible mileage in looking at these things from a structural viewpoint. Things may have moved on. I don't know. But certainly in terms of the work on more complex liquids, then I mean we're still looking there in terms of structures and microphase separation, etc., which I still take a structural view of. All the neutron scattering work that I've been doing in collaboration with various people, we're always ending up by looking at structures, not just radial distributions, partial distribution of functions. In fact, one of the things I'm really pleased about, if you like, is that, I mean, this is going away from glasses, but I remember when I was going to the 72 crystallography congress in Japan, and because I was visiting a colleague in the States just beforehand, I tagged on to a chartered flight that the American crystallographers were organizing. And on that flight, you know, these charter flights those days, the bar was free, and I got into talking to a crystallographer called David Harker, who did some of the early work on protein crystals and some of the early theoretical work on structure solution. And I tried to tell him what I was trying to do. And I said, well, look, what I'd really like to do is to be able to you crystallographers, you've got an ordered structure, you can find the structure of it. What I would like to do is find a way of extracting the structure of a liquid in the same sort of way. And he said at the time, impossible, you can't do that, whereas we actually can. And I'm quite pleased with that, making use of what's possible with neutron scattering, isotope substitution, etc. And again, in the early days of the glass, of the metallic glass work, all people producing there were total pair distribution functions with no way of separating out the partials. And it was only with the advent of isotope substitution and neutron diffraction that the holy grail at the time there could be actually achieved. And in that respect, you know, people like John Enderby, who was instrumental in getting that sort of work going, were very important and very constructive in interactions with me. I like to look at structures, and I think looking at structures helps me to understand things. And they may not help other people, but they certainly do me.
In closing, do you still have notes, papers, and correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Well, the answer is yes, a loft full. It will need a lot of sorting, and who would be interested? Can you answer that question?
We can discuss it afterwards.
Okay.
There's possibilities.
I'm a great hoarder, and so there's all sorts of stuff up there. And when I moved to Rutherford in '88 for that 5 years at the neutron source, I packed a load of papers in boxes, and they're still in those boxes. So there's a lot of sorting to do sometime.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you, Patrick.